My Left Foot by Christy Brown. Copyright Burlington Books, 2001. Chapter 1. The Letter A. I was born on June the 5th, 1932. There were 9 children before me and 12 after me, so I belong to the middle group. Mine was a difficult birth, I am told. Both mother and son almost died. A whole army of relations queued up outside the hospital until the early hours of the morning, waiting for news and praying that it would be good. After my birth, mother was sent to recuperate for some weeks, and I was kept in the hospital while she was away. I remained there for some time without name, for I wasn't baptised until my mother was well enough to take me to church. It was mother who first saw that there was something wrong with me. I was about 4 months old at the time. She noticed that my head had a habit of falling backwards whenever she tried to feed me. She attempted to correct this by placing her hand on the back of my neck to keep it steady. But when she took it away, it dropped again. That was the first warning sign. Then she became aware of other defects as I got older. She saw that my hands were clenched nearly all of the time and tended to twist behind my back. At 6 months, I could not sit up without having a mountain of pillows around me. At 12 months, it was the same. Very worried by this, mother told my father her fears, and they decided to seek medical advice without any further delay. I was about 1 year old when they began to take me to hospitals and clinics, convinced that there was something wrong with me. Something which they could not understand or name, but which was very real and disturbing. Almost every doctor who saw and examined me said that I was a very interesting but also a hopeless case. Many told mother very gently that I would always be mentally defective. They assured her that nothing could be done for me. She refused to accept that there was no cure and no hope for me. She could not and would not believe that I was an imbecile, as the doctors told her. In spite of all that the doctors and specialists told her, she would not agree. I don't believe she knew why. She just knew that she was right. Finding that the doctors could not help in any way, mother decided there and then to take matters into her own hands. I was her child and therefore part of the family. No matter how backward and incapable I might grow up to be, she was determined to treat me the same as the others and not as the queer one in the back room who was never spoken of when there were visitors present. That was a momentous decision as far as my future life was concerned. It meant that I would always have my mother on my side to help me fight all the battles that were to come and to inspire me with strength. Mother wasn't content just to say that I was not an idiot. She set out to prove it. She did it because she loved me, not because of any sense of duty. That is why she was so successful. 4 years passed, and I was still as helpless as a newly born baby. While my father was out at bricklaying, earning our bread and butter for us, mother was slowly, patiently pulling down the wall, brick by brick, that seemed to exist between me and the other children. I could not speak or even mumble, nor could I sit up without support on my own, and I certainly couldn't walk. But I wasn't inert or motionless. I seemed to be convulsed with movement, wild, stiff, snake-like movement that never left me, except in sleep. My fingers twisted continually, my arms curled backwards and often shot out suddenly, and my head continually fell sideways. I was a crooked little fellow. Mother tells me how one day she had been sitting with me for hours in an upstairs room, showing me pictures out of a great big storybook that I had got for Christmas. Then, at the end of it, she leaned over me and said gently into my ear, "Did you like it, Chris? Did you like the bears and the monkeys and all the lovely flowers? Nod your head for yes, like a good boy." But I could make no sign that I had understood her. Her face was bent over mine, hopefully. Suddenly, involuntarily, my queer hand reached up and grasped one of the dark curls that fell in a thick cluster about her neck. Gently, she loosened the clenched fingers, though some dark strands were still held between them. Then she turned away from my curious stare and left the room crying. The door closed behind her. It all seemed hopeless. My relatives wanted to put me in an institution. "Never!" said my mother almost fiercely when this was suggested to her. "I know my boy is not an idiot. It is his body that is broken, not his mind. I'm sure of that." I was now 5, and still I showed no real sign of intelligence. I had no apparent interest in anything. I was lonely, imprisoned in a world of my own, unable to communicate with other people. I felt separated from them, as though a glass wall stood between my existence and theirs. I wanted to run about and play with the others, but I was unable to escape from my prison. Then, suddenly, it happened. In a moment, everything was changed. My future life moulded into a definite shape. My mother's faith in me rewarded, and her secret fear changed into open triumph. It happened so quickly, so simply, after all the years of waiting and uncertainty. I can still see and feel the whole scene as if it had happened last week. It was the afternoon of a cold, grey December day. The streets outside were white with snow and the sparkling flakes stuck and melted on the window panes. Inside, all the family were gathered round the big kitchen fire that lit up the little room with a warm glow and made giant shadows dance on the walls and ceiling. In a corner, my sister Mona and my brother Paddy were sitting together. They were writing down little sums on an old slate, using a bright piece of yellow chalk. I was close to them, laying on a few pillows against the wall, watching. It was the chalk that had attracted me so much. I had never seen anything like it before, and it contrasted so well with the black surface of the slate that I was fascinated by it. Suddenly, I wanted desperately to do what my sister was doing. Then, without thinking or knowing exactly what I was doing, I reached out and took the stick of chalk out of my sister's hand with my left foot. I do not know why I used my left foot to do this. It is a puzzle to many people, as well as to myself, for, although I displayed a curious interest in my toes at an early age, I had never before tried to use either of my feet in any way. They could have been as useless to me as were my hands. That day, however, my left foot, apparently on its own, reached out and took the chalk out of my sister's hand. I held the chalk tightly between my toes and, acting on an impulse, made a wild sort of scribble with it on the slate. Then I looked up and became aware that everyone had stopped talking and was staring at me silently. Nobody moved. Mona looked at me with great big eyes and an open mouth. On the other side of the room, his face lit by flames, sat my father, leaning forward, hands on his knees, his shoulders tense. I felt the sweat on my forehead. My mother came in from the kitchen with a steaming pot in her hand. She stopped halfway between the table and the fire, feeling the tension flowing through the room. She followed their stare and saw me in the corner. Her eyes looked from my face down to my foot, with the chalk gripped between my toes. She put down the pot. Then she crossed over to me and knelt down beside me, like she had done many times before. "I'll show you what to do with it, Chris," she said, very slowly in a queer, jerky way, her face flushed red as if with some inner excitement. Taking another piece of chalk from Mona, she hesitated, then very deliberately drew on the floor in front of me the single letter A. "Copy that," she said, looking steadily at me. "Copy it, Christy." I couldn't. I looked about me, looked around at the faces that were turned towards me, tense, excited faces that were at that moment frozen, immobile, eager, waiting for a miracle in their midst. I tried again. I put out my foot and made a wild, jerking movement with the chalk, which produced a very crooked line on the floor and nothing more. "Try again, Chris," she whispered in my ear. "Again." I did. I stiffened my body and put my left foot out again for the third time. I drew one side of the letter. I drew half the other side. Then the stick of chalk broke. I wanted to give up. Then I felt my mother's hand on my shoulder. I tried once more. Out went my foot. I shook. I sweated and strained every muscle. My hands were so tightly clenched that my fingernails dug into the flesh. I set my teeth so hard that I nearly pierced my lower lip. Everything in the room swam, till the faces around me were mere patches of white. But I drew it. The letter A. There it was, on the floor before me. Shaky, with awkward, wobbly sides and a very uneven centre line, but it was the letter A. I looked up. I saw my mother's face for a moment, tears on her cheeks. Then my father bent down and lifted me onto his shoulder. I had done it. It had started. The thing that was to give my mind its opportunity to express itself. True, I couldn't speak with my lips, but now I would speak through something more lasting than spoken words. Written words. That one letter, scrawled on the floor with a broken bit of yellow chalk gripped between my toes, was my road to a new world. My key to mental freedom.